We have lived through an experience of consolidation in the internet industries. They are not the industries they were before. They are controlled by fewer and fewer players. And I think they have to be watched very carefully.
So the world that we have now is not a world in which big companies will continue to dominate everything. It's a very dynamic world, and places like MySpace are no place today, precisely because they couldn't keep up with the competition.
So much of what Richard Epstein wants to happen, so much of this idea of churn, of new companies coming in the industry, of new voices being heard, is a result of some kind of outer limit, and you may not do this.
We are in the situation in which we have a tech boom, not a tech bust, and we ought to be extremely opposed to any particular kinds of proposals that will upset the apple cart in order to secure a series of benefits which we will regret should we ever have them.
Again, the resolution reads, antitrust should take the initiative to control the size of the big tech companies. Taking the affirmative, Tim Wu. Tim, please come to the stage. Yeah. Taking the negative, Richard Epstein. Richard, please come to the stage. Sit on the far chair. Yeah. Jane, please close the voting. And affirmative goes first. That's Tim Wu for 15 minutes. Tim, take it away.
Where should I put that?
Put it there. And then, your timer will be right in front, flashing 5 and 2 minute signs. Go ahead.
All right. Let me begin by saying that was the least relaxing comedy routine I've heard in a while, but I'll try and make you feel better. So, as I see it, we are on the tail end of a 20-year experiment in which we have allowed an unprecedented and in many ways un-American abandonment of the principles of competition and the ideals of a decentralized economy. And it is my proposition today that we need to begin to reverse those policies, to begin to have greater control in the interests of competition, in the interests of free markets, over consolidation of this economy. And I believe that approach should begin with big tech, which is a poster child, the most visible form of monopoly in most of our lives, and also an industry and a series of companies which have developed a dangerous level of power over not only the economy, but also politics in our country, over even our daily lives and the accumulation of data and private information. It is my proposition that it is the American tradition and an important role in the economy to have some controls over monopoly, even if you believe in a free market. The abandonment of even the most minimal controls has led us to a situation that is unacceptable. And I want to give four reasons for that in the time that I have remaining to me. So the first is an argument from antitrust in general, which is the argument that monopolies simply take too much away from the economy and are inefficient. So these are the economic arguments. I want to point out to you that in the last 20 years, in a period which we've allowed unprecedented consolidations of so many American industries, we've been left with a country where Americans pay more for so many basic items, whether it's broadband, whether it's our cell phone plans, whether it's airplane tickets, healthcare, pharmaceuticals. So across the board, across industries, the abandonment or the weakening of antitrust has had the predictable effect of allowing oligopolies or monopolies to arise and across industries and give people less for more money. I think many of us have experienced this firsthand. If you have had any interactions with the healthcare system, if you feel that the airline industry with just three majors might have seemed to have increased prices, increase its fees on everything, reduce your seat sizes, that's sort of the poster child allowing consolidation of the airline industry of what the rest of the economy is beginning to look like, including a big tech. And I want to add to it that across the line weakening of antitrust, weakening of the basic idea that monopolization is illegal, that mergers of competitors should not be allowed, has also contributed to the problem of inequality, which, you know, regardless, unless you're across this political spectrum, is become the looming issue of our time. And that is for a number of reasons I'd be happy to discuss in questions. But the basic economic principle is that if you allow excessive corporate consolidation, if you it leads predictably to higher corporate profits, which are generally returned to shareholders in terms of either stock buybacks or dividends or other methods, which tends to accelerate the tendency of a smaller number of citizens to have more money than the rest. And this, as I'll pick up in the political side of the debate, has exacerbated many of the political contentions, the division of the United States, a sense that the coasts of the country are in some ways in a much different position than the center of the country. These are all trends that are exacerbated, I don't say exclusively caused, but exacerbated by the weakening of antitrust enforcement, the abandonment of the curbs on monopoly. So the second reason I want to focus on, which is specific to the tech monopolies, is the problem that tech monopolies, like other monopolists, simply take too much from the rest of the economy. Now, Richard may argue in his time, and I suspect he will, that the good thing about the tech monopolies is that they have provided new conveniences and services to consumers. And I concede that. I don't deny that these are good companies. I think that they are, I don't think these are sort of the stagnant backwaters or anything like that. But the problem in allowance of tech monopoly is the degree to which it starts to seize income, seize revenue, seize opportunity from the rest of the economy. People who are at all, to take one example, what is the problem with Amazon? The problem with Amazon isn't that it's bad for consumers. The problem for Amazon is the effect it has on other parts of the economy like suppliers, and where its buying power results in it having the ability to squeeze suppliers across the economy and make it very difficult for them to make a profit. Now, Amazon at this point has not even reached its full extent. But if you imagine a future where Amazon is the more or less exclusive way of doing business, if it has no real competitors in the retail sector, it's not hard to see that's a very difficult economy to make money in if you're anyone other than tech or other than Amazon. So I think this the main problem when you focus on a company like Amazon, which in some ways is very appealing, and I will concede those points, is the effects on the rest of the economy and the squeeze of opportunity and profits. The third point I wish to raise in defense of this proposition is the fact that antitrust actually has a strong and good track record when it comes to the problem of tackling tech monopoly. Now, I don't want to have a lengthy lecture on the history of the antitrust laws, but I want to talk about three times that the government has taken on tech monopolies in the past and has produced good results for the U.S. economy. So in the 1970s and the 1980s, the giants of the day were IBM and AT&T. And at a time when the United States was facing increased competition from Japan, not unlike the competition we face now from China, where the idea was that we should be supporting our national champions, we should be helping out AT&T and IBM, the approach of the U.S. government was very different. It broke from the approach that the Japanese were taking, which was not unlike China's, to support their monopolies, to give them everything they wanted, to make sure they were not subject to excessive competitive pressure. And instead, the U.S. government took aim at IBM and AT&T and attempted to break up both of these firms. At the time, many people said this was a terrible idea. At a time, with a rehearsal of many of the arguments people said, everyone loves the Bell system. They rely on it. IBM is a beloved American innovator. No one could be better. These are the arguments I think that we'll hear today about how great and thoughtful and efficient these firms were. Nonetheless, the U.S. government took their case. They broke AT&T up into eight different firms, and they nearly broke up IBM, but certainly chased it around for 13 years and forced it to separate software from hardware. The consequences of those cases, as I said, people at the time said it'd be a terrible idea. But if you look at the companies and the economic activity that was opened up by the cases against the great monopolies, they actually form much of today's economy. In the chase against IBM or the pressure on IBM, it opened the software industry and gave rise to companies, first small ones, but later companies like Microsoft, companies that would later grow into the monopolists themselves. In the pressure put on IBM to make sure it didn't excessively dominate the PC space, out came companies like IBM, Intel, Epson, the old printer maker. In other words, these campaigns against the computer monopolist made it obvious in retrospect that a lot was being held back. And I think if the government does conduct campaigns that is actually currently involved in against Facebook, Google, Amazon, it will begin to give space to the entrepreneurs that have always been the backbone of growth of the U.S. economy. And I think that if we surrender and we say, well, we shouldn't do anything, worship our great tech companies, we should trust them to take us to the future, that we're going to look back at some period and wonder, those companies that seemed so great 5 or 10 years ago have begun to stagnate, have become more like General Motors, Chrysler, Ford, companies that grew too big, stayed around too long, and ultimately held up the American economy. All right, I want to turn to my final reason why I think that it's important to have scrutiny of big tech and consider limiting size, and that is a political argument about centered on the American distrust for concentrated, unaccountable power. I think that we live in a time where we have to recognize that there is too much potential and, in fact, exercised power in a few small tech firms. This is a consequence not only of their aggregation of data, but also by the fact that a disproportionate amount of speech, a disproportionate amount of what people see and hear goes through just several small platforms. And no matter what your political persuasion is, no matter what you think of this candidate or that candidate, I think it's important to be wary of a system so centered on just a few platforms, one that has already proven itself vulnerable to foreign manipulation, and one that is constantly at risk of being a system with a single point of failure. I think it's much safer, time has told us, to have a more decentralized system for speech, to have multiple points of failure, and not to just have one or two companies, and in fact, the decision of just a few people, decide what is sayable or not sayable, to decide potentially who has the advantage in an election. I'm struck by the fact that when you consider the debate over Facebook's advertising, political advertising, how much is decided, how much, in effect, everyone assumes the decisions of one person, Mark Zuckerberg, will have on the 2020 election. And if there's any principle that is supposed to be the principle of democracy, it's that, one person shall have no kingly prerogative to decide where political power should lie. I add to that, finally, the problem that monopolies have always had excessive influence over the outcomes of political discourse. And we are in a position where we risk a future where tech monopolies, in some sense, replace, in many aspects, government in our lives and decide what it means to live, decide the most important conditions of our lives, and decide things. And in that sense, the question of whether you think we should have more discipline on the tech monopolies is in some ways a question of whether you believe in democracy or not, because we have in some ways aggregated a lot of the most important public decisions to a series of smaller companies. I think for the principles of democracy alone, that trend must be resisted, even if we occasionally like to order things that arrive in one day. Thank you very much, and look forward to...
Richard Epstein for the negative. You take the podium, Richard?
Yeah. Can I use his extra 2 minutes?
No, you can't. Not for sale.
That all rights were alienable under these circumstances.
15 minutes for Richard.
It's a very great pleasure to be here, and let me see if I can state the opposite side of the position. Tim began with a statement that just think of what the antitrust laws has been like in the last 20 years and how much things have changed. Well, if you start going back to, say, 2020, and you ask yourself who was not around, all of the companies that he now wants to regulate were either much smaller or non-existent at that particular point in time, and all of them have generally grown. At the same time, if you start looking at the positions with respect to the antitrust laws, it's not as though they've taken an abnegation on the way in which monopoly ought to be controlled. Just yesterday, I read a long disquisition by the Deputy Attorney General, who announced that in these particular cases, we are going to continue with the set of sanctions that we impose upon a cartel formation by giving leniency for the first person to confess so that we can throw everybody else in jail, and then we'll work out other kinds of arrangements. There's absolutely no sign whatsoever across either the Clinton or the present administration or any administration in between that the case against cartels has not been made. If you look at the merger market, the same kind of guidelines that have always been used before are now being used again. And basically what happens is if you're trying to go 3-2 or 2-1, you can't do that. If you're trying to go 5-4 and you check the analysis, generally speaking, a word which Tim did not mention but which needs to be mentioned is that the efficiencies associated with some of these unions are greater than any restrictive prices they could get. And so the case that's on the basically on the cutting edge is the 4-3 merger. And that seems to me also to be a situation which is sound on antitrust law. Then if you start looking at the way in which various companies start to work, there's been a very established doctrine for a long time which says that if you, in fact, are able to achieve your particular growth through internal expansion, through acumen or through good luck, this is not an antitrust violation. It is, in effect, something which says that the reason you got where you got is not because you have monopoly power where none exist, that you created opportunities for other individuals which were never available to you before. And so as I start to look at the antitrust laws that's come down, there has been a pretty strong Democrat and Republican consensus with respect to these particular positions. And the question is, why would anybody want to change something, given the fact if you look at the European market, which has a rather different antitrust laws, the number of new corporations of any consequence or size that it's been able to create is exactly zero. And they spend most of their time trying to figure out how they could wreck American companies because they have a kind of international envy associated with the operation of the system. So that's the first point. Then when you start coming to the question, is there anything specific about tech markets, it turns out that the first thing you have to do is to remember what the question was. And the question was, do we want to limit the size of these companies? The question was not whether or not we ought to give all of these companies a free pass in the way in which we start to deal with these particular issues. So I'm happy to report right now I'm working on a case and which is not on the Google side. It's on the other side of this particular circumstances. And as an antitrust lawyer over the past years, I've been a plaintiff's guy and I've been a defendant's guy because it seems to me that the system, once you get it right, is something which has a certain amount of sense and balance associated with its operation. So if the question is whether you want to break up these companies, the question that you have to then ask is a simple one. Do you think that there's some other kind of remedy that you can do with respect to the practices that these companies undertake, which would solve the monopoly problem without creating the breakup problem? Now, why is it that you want to do this? Breaking up, as they like to say, is very, very hard to do. Particularly if you're in a network kind of industry, if you break up the network, then people from one side of the industry cannot get contact to people on the other side of the industry unless what you do is you create a series of interconnection agreements, which, as we know from the telephone industry, turn out to be extremely difficult to execute. And indeed, when Tim mentioned that they broke up the situation with respect to AT&T in 1982, it wasn't because the antitrust laws were inadequate. It's because we had this elaborate system of regulation by the FCC, which shielded it from the antitrust laws, and then they broke it up. It is worth mentioning, however, when they broke it up, they didn't know how to break it up. And so what happened is the consolidation that took place afterwards showed the folly of the system that had been created, which having local exchange carriers on the one side and AT&T's or long lines carrier on the other side, it turned out that the much more efficient system was companies vertically integrated on the one hand, coupled with that new arrival, which they never took into account in 1982. What are we supposed to do with the cell phone when it comes along? And by the time you get to 2005, there are more cell phones than it turned out there were landlines. And the whole stuff that Harold Green was doing essentially turned out to be quite farcical because he put such inhibitions with respect to innovation that took place that the general view was that he held back progress in that particular industry by several years. You look at IBM, and it's the same kind of story. It basically is a prelude to a case that Tim did not mention, which is the Qualcomm case on which I work. And AT&T was, rather, the IBM case was brought the day before the Johnson administration went out of power, just as the Qualcomm case was brought by the Obama administration 3 days before it went out of power. And is this thing going to do any good? Well, what was the theory that you had against IBM? It was very difficult to talk about. It slowed things up, and then when Bill Baxter, the very person who decided to prosecute the AT&T case, came along, he dismissed with prejudice the IBM case, saying that it was meritless. And in fact, in the interim, what did it do to IBM? It certainly slowed its kind of innovation up because you now know every time you're going to engage in a new product or a new price, somebody's going to come and look at you and say, aha, you're now engaged in a form of monopoly. What did they do is they gave opportunities for many other companies to get into business by selling to them stuff which they could then use. And it turns out if you look at companies like Microsoft and Apple later on, it turns out many of these companies actually had sensible relationships with IBM before they spun off and did their own thing. If you recall, Bill Gates had an opportunity to buy back his operating system because I believe it was IBM decided it just didn't want it in a rare display of commercial acumen by a large company. What you have to understand is that these big guys, in some cases, have huge advantages, but in some cases, they're at an enormous disadvantage. If you want to do a startup, you cannot do it being a little bank inside a big bank. You have to be an independent company, or otherwise you cannot align the incentives of your inventors for what's going on. So the world that we have now is not a world in which big companies will continue to dominate everything. It's a very dynamic world, and places like MySpace are no place today precisely because they couldn't keep up with the competition. It wasn't the antitrust law that spelled the end of the AOL situation. Remember, it was going to take over Time Warner, and by the time it was done, it was history, and Time Warner had to ditch it. These are amazingly dynamic markets. And the fact that you have dominant players today and dominant players 10 years ago and dominant players 10 years from now doesn't mean that you're going to have the same dominant players at all these times. The churn is every bit as important as the current consideration. And every current so-called monopolist knows that there is a sword of Damocles hanging over their heads, which will say, if we make a misstep, it will be our last step. And somebody else will then come along under these circumstances and take all of the particular situations that we have and move them to the other side. So then how is it when you want to do this thing, do you start to think about the way in which these industries ought to be regulated? And the first thing that you start to do is you say, well, look, they're not all the same kinds of industries, and they all may need very different kinds of treatments, and you have to be careful that you've gotten the right treatment. So what are you going to do with respect to Amazon, whose major sign is reliable delivery on the one hand at low prices on the other? First thing you do is remember, they don't win in every market in which they enter. There are certain cases in which smaller, more adept players are much better. And when you're trying to look at this particular stuff, what you have to remember is it's not the global size that determines competitive structure. A large company like Amazon can face competition in each local market by two or three small people who are much more adept in their own space than Amazon can be. So that it's not a case of essentially the big guy having no competition. It's not a case of the big guy having competition by one or two other companies. It's a case of a big guy having lots of competition from lots of companies in lots of different markets. And it has a disadvantage that it has to form national policy when they try to figure out how it is that they deal with local situations. So what should we do with Amazon? Buy away with respect to their goods and don't read the Washington Post. And it seems to me that you will come up with, and somebody laughed at least, you will come up with something that looks to be the same thing. If you look at the situation with respect to Microsoft, they wanted to put all sorts of duties on it so that they could not introduce products that would have anti-competitive edges, and they had to establish the compatibility with services from other people. And IBM took a terrible advantage of the situation by saying, you have to examine protocols with hundreds after hundreds of different products that we're going to put out. It's going to cost you a fortune, and most of these things that we're asking you to examine for this kind of stuff turn out to be stuff that we're never going to use. If you continue down this particular line and take the recent Qualcomm situation, in one of the worst judgments ever entered into in the history of antitrust law, you take America's major 5G company and you want to subject to world revision of the rates being done in a San Jose court to telling them how they ought to file and deal with their products when they're selling them in Korea or in Japan or other places which have, in fact, their own antitrust law. This is absolutely crazy. And then it turns out that when they start to go somewhat further, what you say in the fact is that the antitrust law now gives you a duty to compete, not only to compete with your competitors, but to supply them at below market prices your particular technology so that they compete with you. And the Trinco Doctrine, which was one that was established in about 2004, makes it very clear that your antitrust obligation is not to support your competitors, but to try and run your own business in a perfectly coherent and general way. So if you start to look at the way in which the remedial structure comes out in these particular cases where there has been found to be an antitrust violation, what you typically discover is that the remedy in many of these cases turns out to be far worse than the disease, and it turns out that the best way in which to deal with this stuff is, in fact, to encourage new entry by removing whatever barriers to entry it turns out to be. Now, what are these barriers to entry? Well, sometimes it's kind of funny. Let me just mention to you two things. One is Jonathan Barnett has an excellent new book, and what he says is the key barrier to entry in many of the tech industries is a weak, not a too strong patent law. And why is that? Because the companies that are entering are small companies. They do not have an elaborate industrial structure. Either they get patent protection or they get nothing. But if you're an Intel or if you're some large company, you can protect yourself by contracting, by trade secrets and other devices. And so you get the paradox that it's all the big and established companies that are opposed to strong patent protection and all of the small companies which turn out to be in favor of it. So if you're trying to figure out what it is that's going on in these cases when you're figuring out the ways in which these things are going to take place, it turns out that it's much more difficult to do that than Tim has said. Then there's also the problem of what counts as a barrier to entry. There's a danger of many kinds of, shall we say, fictive cases as well as some real cases. So a fictive case is a recent suggestion that the reason we find that Facebook has a barrier to entry is that it lulled people in with a promise of strong privacy protection, then changed the rules, and by that time it had a monopoly position. That's the kind of crazy theory that nobody should give credit to. If you don't like the privacy policies, you can ask Facebook to amend them, and they've done it multiple times, or you can decide to take your business elsewhere. And a company like Snapchat, not that I use any of these particular services, turns out to be getting much greater shares than you have. So you have to be very careful when people simply allege that there's abuse to look at it closely. On the other hand, if you're a company like Google and you're running a network and what you do is you make it impossible by removing an old technology for one of your competitors to sell their stuff, that's a very serious operation. It's not straight an antitrust case. It's also a case that has to do, by and large, with your competitive obligations, your good faith services, and so forth. Now, last, what Tim mentioned was that we have to worry about the internet and the control of ideas. And he made a statement of the sort which Mark Zuckerberg should not have that much influence, articulate though he may be. Well, I run three podcasts a day, not a day, a week on average, and basically none of them go through Facebook, although they can transport it. What happens is the rise of the internet has meant that little guys, insignificant as I turn out to be, turn out to find somebody like the Hoover Institution wants to put them out there. You could get free access to all places on the internet, and somebody like me who'd never been heard of under the great age beforehand, where you had large fixed telephone companies, can all of a sudden get a voice. And if you start looking at the number of sites in every industry that have independent production capabilities, what you're impressed with is the cacophony of different voices rather than with the fact that under these circumstances you have only one person who could speak at all. Why is this? Because water essentially always finds its way. If it turns out that one particular path is blocked, you will take another path in order to get what you think to be the appropriate way in which you want to move your particular resources. And so what you do is you get an absolutely unmatched variety of things that take place because free entry on the web is extremely powerful. My friend Larry Lessig actually had one very good idea, which was the Creative Commons, which allows also small people for credit to get their stuff out. So we are in the situation in which we have a tech boom, not a tech bust, and we ought to be extremely opposed to any particular kinds of proposals that will upset the apple cart in order to secure a series of benefits which we will regret should we ever have them. Thank you.
Yeah. Good. Yeah. Tim, 5 minutes rebuttal from Tim Wu. Take it away, Tim.
All right. That's. Let me. Get my 5 minutes right. All right. Well, Epstein
Tim
is
in charge. Of that.
Oh, give me the 5 minutes. Well, you know, I don't know. You've done me the favor of giving me a lot to fight at, and I want to start with just starting with your misunderstanding of the history of these tech industries. If you look at the narrative of the last 30 years, is not a narrative where the industry sort of naturally took care of itself. It's a narrative of the industry turning to monopolies, and at crucial points, antitrust interventions, breaking things up, and rebooting what was becoming a dangerously consolidated industry. You know, you talked about how we have all these firms, Google, Microsoft, and you name it. But those are the outshoots of a very successful attack on Microsoft, which was in a very dangerous position of controlling the browser in about 2001. Now, these are very good companies. But I think the system we've had, the reason that American tech has been the leader of the world is because we haven't done what Japan has done. We haven't done what China's about to do, which is just stay away from the big monopolies, let them dominate the tech spaces in their areas, never break them up, never threaten them. And I suggest we've had a very successful plan of putting the tech monopolists to the test, forcing them to compete hard, not allowing them to build up artificial barriers of entry, and has completed an extraordinary, and it deserves credit along with the companies themselves for the success of American tech. So I think that what you're actually describing is an abandoning of what has been an incredibly successful program. Now, second of all, you suggested that it's sort of impractical to limit size and turn to the question of what this debate's all about. So first of all, the proposition is that we should limit the future size of tech companies. So what I'm suggesting is that we not necessarily we have to break up every tech firm, but at the very least, we need to stop the big tech monopolies from buying their most dangerous competitors. That is what Facebook did, and that is the core of the case against Facebook, is that they bought their most dangerous competitors in Instagram and WhatsApp, and have bought others, which people don't know the names as well because they're not as prominent. And Google has, you know, for their sake, bought 260 of their competitors or so. Many of these were very friendly acquisitions. I don't think the people minded getting the payoffs. But the net consequence is when you have too many companies allowed to buy off too many of their competitors, that you end up with an environment that is overly monopolized, overly concentrated. And I think this is a danger to the viability, the future competitiveness of American tech. I think you and I both agree that what has been the success of American tech is churn. The question is whether that happens naturally or whether government, by putting scrutiny on anti-competitive practices, on preventing companies from building up barriers to entry, of giving entrepreneurs their shot, of making the tech economy a place of opportunity as opposed to a place where monopolies can do whatever they want, whether that is what leads us finally to churn. A minute on, you know, the sort of question of political danger. I, along with you, agree that the internet has allowed a lot of voices, obviously, to get out there in a way that was challenging. But that is a view that is, I would say, threatened by the domination of just a few platforms. As it stands, if you think about the speech codes or the speech codes and the controls of the main tech platforms, they are deciding what speech is on the internet. And I think that should be a decentralized set of questions. And I want to end by something once that kind of gives me a sense of why I think antitrust is an important player and why I think there should always be a public role in deciding what happens in the private tech industries. Once I had an opportunity to talk to Bill Gates, and I slowly moved the topic to antitrust, suggesting I was a historian more than an antitrust advocate. And he said something very interesting, which I just want to close on. He said he didn't really like the case, and he said all these sort of things. But he said, I'd had a lot of things go my way. I sort of deserve my comeuppance. And it did get me into philanthropy about 7 years sooner. So I want to suggest there is this positive role in control of any form of power, including private power, and including the power of the tech industries. Thanks.
5 minutes rebuttal from Richard.
I think we have to be extremely careful to figure out what it is that is and is not a barrier to entry, what is and is not something that Rather hopes. There is much too much of a danger now to put attention with respect to the antitrust law, although that's the only operative force that exists. So with respect to new entry, I've already mentioned to you the importance of the patent system. It's also absolutely critical that you don't have something like the Fair Labor Standards Act interfere with the churn and the competition of new companies when they start to take over. It's also clear that the rules that exist in the securities industry, which make it progressively difficult for companies to start to go public, has led to a system where some of these companies are going to be acquired. The second thing I think you have to do is it's extremely difficult when you start looking at these mergers to realize whether or not these are efficiency gains, that you're watching a monopoly practice. You're a company called Google, and you take over a company called Waze. It's got 12 employees. It's got revenues of absolutely nothing. And what you have here is an incredible synergy that can take place when somebody's got a map connection, which is second to none, and somebody else has got a technology that can be put to use. And so the question you then have to ask is whether or not you want these two people to go separately, at which point the synergies are going to have to come in some other way, and it could delay these things from happening to begin with. The third thing I think that one has to remember on this stuff is if you have several large companies that are always in the market for buying small companies or can go public, this is going to be a strong inducement for people to start to create new companies that are going to start to take over. So if you start looking at the Obama era, it turns out that anything that looked like technical innovation was something that they viewed with presumptive suspicion. The moment he's out of office and you then start to look at the number of startups, you see an absolute U-turn taking place on this thing because it's generally thought that the Trump administration was sufficiently incompetent or sufficiently indifferent that it wasn't going to wreck the way in which these companies started to operate. And this has nothing whatsoever to do with the antitrust law. It has to do with the question as to whether or not when you start to do one of these particular businesses, you're going to be able to find out, having done this particular business, that you're going to be able to obtain, to some extent, some kind of a decent turn with respect to the way in which it goes. The second point is, when you're dealing with the antitrust laws, this is not a matter of aspiration. This is a matter of technique. And it turns out, as I mentioned earlier, it's not a question as to whether you think there is or is just a violation and so forth. The question is, what's the kind of remedies that you want to impose? So if you want to impose a breakup on a large company like Microsoft, what you're going to do is separate its operating system on the one hand from its various peripheral operations on the other. This will do absolutely nothing in antitrust firms because it turns out that the monopoly power, if you have one, is in the operating system. And so long as that is kept as a unified whole, then it turns out that the problem is going to exist whether or not you spin off the application side of the business or not. And then if you try to break up the operating system, you do run into a very serious problem under the circumstances, which is the way in which you're now going to get the two parts to start to interconnect with one another. There are other problems. So, for example, you talk about privacy. And this is a hugely important issue. And oftentimes, it's extremely difficult to figure out exactly who's responsible for what when leaks start to take place and data is taken over and so on. If you have one or two large companies with large databases and there's a leak, generally speaking, it's easy to track down where it comes from than if you have a number of small companies who may have less effective techniques with respect to the ways in which these operate than the larger companies. And so that what you can do is, in an effort to try to deal with the antitrust kinds of issues, is you could create exposures that you don't want to welcome in other kinds of areas. So when you start to think about this question of breaking up, this is a momentous problem. Generally speaking, you could say with perfect confidence that if you start to break these people up, that the value of the shares and its constituent parts is going to be less than the whole when it's put together. At that particular point, if you're running a social examination, what you then have to do is to figure out exactly where the social gain is coming from with respect to the breakup, and you can't show that. What you can show is, in effect, that new people trying to come into the industry will have fewer people with whom they can deal and so forth. There'll be privacy problems. There'll be huge transactions costs. There may be serious misallocations in the way in which you allocate things from one point to another. You don't want to do it. And just the last point is, when it comes to the political markets, they're particularly vibrant today, precisely because there's so many more channels now than there were ever before. This is a case where technology has gotten rid of the problem of holdup, has reduced the influence of the FCC, and we're all the better off for that, because, again, what we want to remember is that technology can enable just as it can restrict. And so the point is to look to those bad practices that firms undertake and to stop them, but to stop messing around with the size of the industry in the vain hope you can make this thing actually work. Thank you.
Thanks to you both. We now go to the Q&A part of the evening. I mentioned to Tim Wu and now to you, Richard, we'll give you guys any opportunity you want to ask each other questions at any time. There's often just an inclination to solicit the audience's questions first. So line up at the mic since you'll be up pretty soon. I do want to take moderator's prerogative to just ask one question of Tim Wu and then have Richard comment. When Tim emphasized a couple of times that the question is you say that it's too big, but then what do you do? What would you do about Amazon? If you, let's say to a rule, well, you're too big, we've got to do some breakup, we've got to do some curbing, what would you curb, what would you break up?
Yeah, I don't have any blanket sort of a rule that says you have to do anything. I think it is important to be case by case, to be sensitive. I think it would be not disruptive and good for competition, for Facebook. Are you all right?
Yeah. Okay.
And that's not even the coronavirus. Get up. Oh, my God.
Okay, no.
Sorry.
No bones broken, just a little milk on the floor. And I think we're okay. All right. Yeah. Good. Yeah. All right, Tim, that broke your train of thought big time. So maybe you want to go back, dial it back a little bit and start again. Go ahead.
Yeah, sure. Yeah. What we were talking about? Oh, yeah, tech.
You were breaking somebody up.
Right. So I don't have any grand aspirations to say, we have a rule, we break up every firm because you do it for the joy of it. I think if you need to look carefully at every situation and ask whether it would do better with competition in obvious ways. And I want to give an example where I think that's true. So Facebook, in my view, illegally acquired two of its most dangerous competitors, WhatsApp and Instagram. It is a violation of the Sherman Act to buy your competitors because the antitrust law believes in competition, not monopoly. And I think you should ask Facebook to divest Instagram and WhatsApp to be separate companies, so that you then have three main social networks competing with each other. I think there's a lot of, contrary to what Rich Epstein said, this is not impossible. This is not something that, destroys life for the American, for the average person. I mean, now you have Instagram and WhatsApp and Facebook competing with each other. And that is the spirit of the antitrust laws, which is we believe in competition and not in monopoly. I think that those firms facing independent pressure to protect privacy, independent pressure to provide better protection against foreign electoral attack, independent pressure to treat us better, deliver less ads, would deliver the usual consequences of competition over monopoly. So there's an example of a nice breakup that I think actually would do a lot to help the American public and, you know, and also deal with some of these political concerns that I've talked about, just having one person with too much power, which is, you know, an age-old thing that I think we want to resist. So I think you've got to be careful about it. I'm not formulaic. This is everything that has to be done. But I do believe that history has shown time and time again that we sometimes overestimate what's so great about today's monopolists and underestimate competition, underestimate what it means to give opportunities to a bunch of new firms who want to take their chance. In the breakup of AT&T, our last big breakup, everyone said this is going to be the worst, it's going to destroy life as we know it. Out of that fallen tree, out of that carcass, came the companies that created what we now call the internet, because they offered dial-up services, companies like AOL, CompuServe, and so forth, and were able to do so free from this sort of colossal shadow of AT&T. So if you want an economy that looks like America's, I think you should believe in controls and ultimately breakups of illegal mergers or anti-competitive conduct. If you want an economy to look like Japan's, where you just stick with a few big monopolists and hope that they're going to be great and try and defend them. And I want to just make this clear. Richard Epstein's prescriptions are a prescription for doing nothing. If you accept what he says, we continue what we've been doing for the last 20 years, which is weaken antitrust law, which basically does nothing, accepts mergers like the Sprint T-Mobile merger, which we just saw, and we will soon, I believe, have an economy like the Japanese economy where we don't bother anyone, we assume the companies will do for the best, but we lived in stagnant times.
Come in, Richard.
Well, I think Tim is in fantasy land, and let me see if I could explain that why. He made two basic points. One is you want to sort of break up the companies on the Facebook and its acquisition and so forth. The first thing is when these mergers took place, they were very different companies than they were now. There were exhaustive reviews that had been taken under the FTC to see whether or not these things should have gone forward. I think they made a perfectly defensible judgment. It was Bill Kovacic, I think, who was in charge of these things, a real pro in this business. And they decided, given the state of the companies then, that these things, in fact, were not going to be able to win because they were companies that were much smaller than now. Now, if you want to break them up, it's an implicit transfer in some sense, from Facebook to other companies. Perhaps all the shareholders will be just fine. But then there's the next question that starts to take place, and they're twofold. One is it's going to be real hard to get future mergers that make sense technically if you're going to have this consequence coming on you afterwards. And it's also the same problem that they had with respect to Microsoft, which is that if you have yourself an integrated company and you want to break these things up, you're going to have to take thousands upon thousands upon thousands of lines of code and try to figure out which belong to me and which belong to thee, and how it is that you're going to run any connection between these companies when you start to have it. Now, this is not anything that you can do. It's something which they eventually shied away from in the Microsoft case, even though they came up with inferior stuff. Japan is a very different company from the United States. It is not a company which simply lets things alone. Japanese is a company which essentially has had restrictive entry practices from beginning to end imposed by matters of law. And what they've managed to do is to take a once dynamic economy that was going to capture the world in 1980 and have turned it into some kind of an economic doormat precisely because they're mercantilist to the core. The last thing I want to do is to give any protection to any American company when it comes and they start to face competition. And so I mentioned, for example, the Qualcomm stuff, and you get yourself Taiwanese companies and start to chew away at their particular situations. You get counterattacks starting to go on. No sign that there's a lack of competition. The real danger is that there will be a lack of competition if this is going to be taken over and run by a judge in San Jose who does not know what she is talking about or doing when she starts to make these kinds of situations. And so you also have to remember, if you start talking about various kinds of regulation on these companies, you have another monopolist that you have to deal with. It's called Uncle Sam or some of the states. And it's not at all clear that these guys know exactly the way in which it's going to start to happen. So if you start to look, for example, at the Amex merger, which took place, it's a kind of a complicated deal. I think, in effect, the United States eventually backed off. The state of Ohio decided to pursue. But this is a two-sided market, and when you have really complicated two sides of markets, it turns out that unless you have subsidies going across the platform, the market itself turns out to be inefficient. If you look at what the government did with respect to this in the debit card market, they wrecked an industry to a very large extent because they didn't understand the way in which this thing started to work. And so if it's amateur hour in the FTC or amateur hour in the DOJ or amateur hour in the Congress with the likes of Richard Durbin, what you have to do is to realize that you can do an immense amount of damage with the government because at this point there's no new entry that can weaken it. So I think Japan, in fact, is a basket case. We have to avoid all of that. And I think what happens is the steady as you go, perfectly sensible antitrust policy, which is not pussycat and lied down, is the way to continue. We don't need to have special targets for large tech companies because of their size.
Thank you. Okay, question from the floor. Just frame your question as a question, please, and you don't have to identify yourself.
Where does one draw the line between the most successful, most competitive company and a monopoly?
I'll answer that question.
Okay. Yeah.
That's the exact Grinnell compound. What you do is if you're the most successful company because you're the most resourceful company and you get very large share, if there's free entry into this particular business and you provide an efficiency justification, you don't want to mess with success. But if it turns out that the way in which you got this was through mergers or through cartelization, then you do. And so what you do is you figure out the way in which it goes. Now, what makes this somewhat more difficult to deal with is there is clearly a very large sentiment, particularly in Europe, that when you have a dominant platform, even if it's lawfully acquired, do you want to have various service obligations that you're going to impose upon it? And, you know, get the priorities right as to where the ads are placed and things of that sort. My view is that practice restrictions are something that you always ought to consider, but consider them carefully, but that breakup, which goes to the size, is almost always the wrong solution if you got success through size. That's Grinnell. That's the Alcoa case. We ought not to reverse those policies.
A comment from Tim?
Yeah. So I think that, having studied the history of large companies' monopolies, I think they go through a natural life cycle. And often companies become successful and large because they have good products and great innovations and people love them. And that is their early stage. And that's fine. The problems and the time the government needs to get involved is when firms get a little bit older, they become a little less interested in trying to build new products and a lot more interested in trying to keep out potential competitors even at their early stages. In other words, they're not unlike members of Congress who start out talking about how great everything's going to be and become interested only in keeping themselves in power. And that's the point, I think, where antitrust becomes important. I want to make a really key point because he's focused on barriers to entry, which is that failure to enforce the antitrust laws is itself a barrier to entry. And that's what we're talking about here. When you give firms an idea, as we had for the last 20 or 30 years, that you can, 20 years particularly, you can do whatever you want, you can build up barriers to entry, you can buy out your main competitors. There is nothing stopping firms from building up barriers to entry and therefore insulating themselves from the forces of competition, which we both believe in. And, mark my words, I will tell you that if there is no antitrust, or if we keep at the levels we have now, which are pussycat, which are weak, which have allowed firms to, with impunity, buy out their competitors, merge into tight oligopolies, we will face a future in the tech industries where we talk about them and, like, what happened? This used to be, the engine of the U.S. economy, but we decided, well, they can really do no wrong. Let nature take its course. Facebook beat MySpace, so, when there's nothing to worry about, it's like an exception to the usual laws of economies of scale. Mark my words, we will see higher prices, reduced competition, reduced growth, reduced opportunity for entrepreneurs, unless we start eliminating entry barriers, which is what the antitrust law
does. Mark my words, this will never happen. if you start to look at some of these great companies who propose barriers to entry, you could start thinking of companies like AOL, and that really worked out terrifically when they had the first mover. You could look at a company like Jack Welch's GE, which he built, which fell apart when, in fact, it had this. If you engage in sloth and spend your time trying to deal with barriers to entry, basically what you've done is you've signed your own death warrant. One of the constant maxims that people have in competitive industries is that the only way that you can succeed is to cannibalize your own products. That is, if you've got a dominant product at one particular point in time, you know that its half-life is going to be X years. If you don't eat it up and put in a new company, somebody else is going to eat it up. And so you're gone either way. And so the question is, how do you survive? And it requires that. So these companies are constantly innovation laboratories, but it's very difficult in many cases for larger companies to do that because they don't have the right incentives to get small products into big products because it's too small an issue for the top management to worry about. So in the natural cycle, you want small companies to be independently owned, and then when they have a coherent product, either sell it to somebody else or to go public, and there's absolutely no sign that this cycle has stopped. The number of companies that have been built in the last 10 or 20 years with billion-dollar valuations whose names I've never heard of is the number of companies built in the last 5 or 6 years with $1 billion of valuation. I don't know who these people are. But I'm not the relevant audience.
This is the problem. You're talking about 10 years ago.
No, I'm talking about today.
You're talking about 10 years ago.
There's much more innovation today than there's ever been before. The biggest mistake that you had was not with the antitrust.
Well, you got to get out more and talk to more venture capitalists, Richard Epstein.
Okay.
Because you're sticking too much time. You know, you got to talk to where the action is. There's the venture. You talk to any venture capitalists, and they'll say, like, you know, yes, that what we said. You're talking about 10 years ago. You're talking about 15 years ago.
I'm talking about maybe the.
You're talking about the golden age of Silicon Valley, and those days are over.
They're gone, but the new generation of venture capitalists is going up. If you check, for example, levels of patent innovation, which is a pretty good mark of innovation in these things, the number of applications is way up. The number is not way down. I think it's just irresponsible and inaccurate to start to say that when you've had a constant antitrust policy for the last 20 years, which produced the gains 10 years ago, which you said, that somehow or other it's going to produce the failures. The big difference now is that the Obama processes, which were always regulatory on labor and similar kinds of issues, terrible patent statute and so forth, that was really harmful, and I think the things will start to get better. Don't get rid of the antitrust laws, but by heaven's sake, don't try to create any of these fancy innovations, all of which are going to lead to real technological stagnation.
Let's take it to another question.
Hey, this question is mostly for Richard. Many right-wing dissident voices, such as Nicholas J. Fuentes, Mauro Yiannopoulos, Laura Loomer, et cetera, have been banned from social media platforms. And due to the network effect of YouTube, Twitter, Facebook, and whatnot, I don't believe they can reach an audience that their left-wing counterparts can. They can form an obscure blog or a podcast, but these are niche comparatively.
Now, I happen to think that you're onto something which is very serious in these particular cases, but it's just not the internet. The same thing happens to the Federal Society when it tries to run meetings, and it finds that it's going to be picketed. It's happened to Brett Kavanaugh when he wants to run the president. And I think what really has to happen in these cases is the following kind of structural organization. You cannot run any kind of a program if it turns out that you're a partisan with respect to some of the issues. So if Jack Dorsey is a left-winger, he ought to get the hell out of Twitter and let somebody else take it over who's politically indifferent. And I also think, by the way, it may not be an antitrust solution in these cases, but I do think, in fact, there may be a contractual obligation that is being breached when these characters announce, as they always do, they're trying to be fair and impartial and hear all sides. And I would certainly allow for that kind of campaign to go. I think in some of these cases, in fact, the remarks that you make about these people are downright defamatory. And while it is that you may not be required to put them on their network, to start to say about organizations of which I'm a part of support, that they're always fascist operation, or what they're trying to do is to oppress this and the other group, I regard that stuff as very, very serious. So there are remedies, I think, that need to be had, but they're going to be in contract law and they're going to be in defamation law. They're not going to be in antitrust. Well,
so, I want to return again.
Let me just understand Richard's answer. What should these people do who have been banned? What would you do if Facebook and Twitter said to you, Richard, get the hell off?
What I would do, in effect, is, I mean, me, I would basically continue with my podcast because I don't know. I would think if I were a serious institutional competitor, I would sue them for breach of the contract of fair dealing, which they announced to all of their potential customers.
So these people should bring a lawsuit. Who've been?
I mean, my view about it, that would work. Now, the question is, if you go before judges who are completely sympathetic with the people who made that decision, it's not going to work. If you go before neutral judges, I mean, you start to see Prager University getting into problems. I mean, I'm quite appalled at the fact that somebody wants to knock them off, because I agree with many of the things that Dennis says, even though I disagree
with
them.
Look, the reason Richard's...
Please get up to the podium if you want to answer.
The reason Richard's answer didn't quite make any sense is because he's dancing around the fact that there is a problem of concentrated power over speech in these areas, and I don't care what side, whether you're on the right or the left, I think that you don't want a tiny number of platform owners setting speech codes for the United States, and they have, and we have. You know, what's being built right now at Facebook and Twitter, even though some of it may be closer to my politics, is one of the most powerful censorship machines ever built in the history of humankind. And if you're on the wrong end of that, it's very unpleasant. And you know, Richard, suing Facebook for defamation is not an answer for being thrown off. This is the reality of private power. You know, these are people who have strong opinions, and I just think it's too much power concentrated in too few people, and that's one of the reasons that's non-economic, that's frankly political, for why we have the antitrust laws, is to try to fight against this problem of too few individuals.
The antitrust may get you from 3 to 4 firms, and all these firms may have the same politics. It's not going to be a solution to this problem. And what makes it worse is if you don't have private guys doing this, who at least make the appearance of trying to adjust things, you're going to have the government trying to do all this, and then you have a single monopolist who's going to be involved trying to figure out what speech codes it wants. And so now your new situation is to have the speech codes that they put in place at the University of California dominate the way in which everything works. So the answer here is there is no first best answer. The question is, which is the best second best answer? And my view about it is, I think that everybody like Tim, when the moment you start seeing somebody like Twitter do something like that, you go on Twitter and you blast Twitter for engaging in those kinds of activities. I regard it as very, very dangerous, just the way I regard shouting down speakers at public events as being extraordinarily dangerous. To me, the real problem is the polarization and intolerance in American society that puts people like that into these kinds of positions. I think it's really tragic, really tragic, that every one of these big magnates at these big tech companies is hopelessly uninformed left-wing in terms of their politics.
Well, okay, yeah. Next question.
Hi, my name is Michael Madrid. I have a question for Tim. Tim, with regard to takeover of close competitors, you've mentioned, I believe, Instagram and WhatsApp. Do you have other examples you would point to? And you have, I believe you said that enforcement should be flexible.
Yeah.
But I imagine we would need some sort of objective standards. If so, what would you envision?
Yeah, so I think you need to draw the line at mergers to monopoly or 3 to 2. You know, he's talking about 4 to 3s. And stick with the line that it's not okay to buy out your most dangerous competitors. So other examples besides that. I think, for example, that Google should not have been allowed to buy Waze, the other major mapping program. It doesn't make sense to me that you have one company controlling the two major, you know, ways of figuring out from A to Z, how to get from A to B. And the reason is that those firms are both potential platforms for new entrants into these markets. And so there's another example. I question whether some of Amazon's acquisitions should have been allowed, particularly of other online retailers, that where they, you know, might have been another platform to creating more competition in this area. Or maybe they wouldn't be bought out by Walmart or Target to create a stronger competitor. My overall message is that through merger policy, and it's not just the big tech, it's also across the economy and you know, other parts of tech like broadband and which we've focused less on, that we've just sort of given up on the idea of competition. And I don't think you need to be, you know, any kind of raving, you know, right wing, left wing, any person to believe that, you know, competition has a much better track record than does monopoly. And that's what I, this is where I disagree profoundly with Epstein. You sort of, with Richard Epstein, is he sort of naturally believes that everything will take care of itself. But I think the track record suggests from the 19th century onward that many of these industries become monopolies, and the monopolies actually do stick around for a long time. You know, at one time, people thought AT&T was the most vibrant and exciting and innovative company in the world. In the 1950s, people said General Motors is so innovative, we can't ever imagine a company like that stagnating. They just think of something new every day. But these companies managed to, one way or another, create barriers to entry, and they were undisciplined and not subject to the forces of competition, particularly AT&T. And eventually, the wunderkind of today becomes a stagnant monopolist of tomorrow. So that's why I think, you know, like, I'm not that interventionist. I'm just saying you got to keep a watch on it and stop the most aggressive, obvious mergers to monopoly, mergers from 3 to 4, 4 to 3, 3 to 2. And we haven't done that based on this sort of magic dust that we think, oh, you know, there's something magical about tech. You know, it's cyber activated, and, you know, so it doesn't matter. I think what's happening is we're learning that the old economic lessons are too true for tech as well, which is that you that many of these markets tend towards monopoly, and that monopolies in the long run are highly inefficient.
Well, everybody agrees monopolies are highly inefficient, but that doesn't dictate the nature of your merger policy. And so take Waze and Google. Suppose you decided that Waze could not be taken over by Google. There's nothing which says that this tiny little company from Israel would be able to get the sufficient financial backing to become a viable competitor. And so instead of having a more efficient Google, you have to take into account the possibility that you're going to have a less efficient Google and nobody coming in. Then what happens is you put it in there and they merge with Waze. If you have a no barriers to entry policy, it doesn't prevent anybody else from getting a patented or trade secret alternative technology so they could take after the combined company. You're going to say, oh, it's a little bit harder because these guys are more efficient than they would have otherwise had been, but that's to ignore the fact that the efficient company does a lot more service than it would have done if it had been a less efficient company. So I just don't see it. And in terms of the large companies like General, well, AT&T, it was protected by a statutory monopoly. If you go back and you look at the Hush phone case, this monopoly was so powerful in 1956 that when somebody wanted to put a little thing on the end of the receiver so you could hear things better, the FCC said, you can't do that because it's an end-to-end monopoly that runs by AT&T, and these guys are at the end. What broke this down, in effect, and what really has to be given the impression was that MCI decided to run a dedicated line from St. Louis to Chicago in order to transmit data. They didn't need the benefit of the network effect that you have when you're trying to get telephone calls. And then they sued an antitrust violation against AT&T, which was a pretty well-conceived complaint. So the issue is not whether you want to have an antitrust law or a merger policy and so forth, but you've got to be able to apply it correctly. And I think most of the efforts in this particular business are going to be misconceived if you're trying to make sure that little companies that may become big companies cannot be acquired. There's a real benefit of allowing them to be acquired, which is other little companies will come in. And if you want to get them to become public offerings, you have to change the securities law, which have had two very bad effects. It delays the time at which companies go public. It increases the likelihood that they'll be taken over, and it increases the likelihood that companies that are public are going to try to go private. So if you look at the number of listings on the New York Stock Exchange, you want to tell me what the answer is, or should I tell you? It's way down, right? And it's because of a bunch of knuckleheaded policies that have taken place in the SEC. People who are so dumb that they don't realize that the protection you give to a small investor is to say, buy a mutual fund instead of wrecking the market. The current SEC problem says, we got all these Bemis on the fast track. We got to make room for the bicycles. That's what they're trying to do. Unforgivable.
Well, I'm glad you mentioned statutory monopoly, because I think that's an important topic. So statutory monopoly is monopoly protected by government. And one of the, I think, continuing to tolerate and, in fact, celebrate tech monopoly is, I think it's predictable. And, in fact, serving in government, I felt this coming, that the major tech monopolies, Facebook being an example, will begin to ask one way or another, more subtly or less subtly, for protection from competition from government. Now, the way Facebook does this, Facebook, if you haven't noticed recently, has started to ask to be regulated. Now, that might seem a little weird. Why does Facebook want to be regulated? Why do they want privacy laws? Well, they know that if they have influence over privacy law, they can design a regime so complicated, so Byzantine, that it gives Facebook the advantage and makes it almost impossible to start a company because of the startup costs and compliance costs with these privacy regimes. Europe's privacy law, GDPR, which I don't think has been that effective, has, however, been very effective as an insulation of the main tech monopolies from competition. So I think one of the problems with tolerating monopoly is they're not stupid. They understand we need to protect this monopoly. The best way to protect this monopoly is government. We can do that by some of them do it by enormous accumulation of patent. And the other way is just ask for some complicated regulatory regime that keeps us in power and makes it harder to challenge us. So I think that is the next step. I think that's one of the challenges. And to pretend that's not going to happen would be naive.
I think there are two distinctions. One is amassing patents, if you get them in a sensible way to put together a portfolio, can be, as people well understood, a form of vertical integration. In the 1992 antitrust guideline on this, which says that you cannot put into the same patent pool competitors but only complements, is in fact an appropriate response. That was done, I think it was, under either the late Bush or the early Clinton administration, and it's a perfectly good deadline. What Tim says about the other thing is going to the government to ask themselves to regulate me so as to raise my rivals' costs even greater is the absolute kind of thing that a classical libertarian like myself gags on, because what it does is it shows the dangers. But this has happened all the time. You get organizations like the TVA and other kinds of places that get government subsidies to operate, and then they put restrictions on private firms, and so that's a way of killing private enterprise. And then what you do is you get other private firms that get the inside track, and they could then kill upstarts coming in from without. And so the basic rule here is never, 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 ever, ever, ever let people go to the government. So I think Tim would...
How do you prevent that from happening? They're already there. I was in government, and Facebook comes and says, we want to be your friends.
And one of the things we have to do is take care of Norr Pennington, one of the worst decisions ever, which essentially says that if you petition the government for cartel-like activities, you get an absolute immunity from the antitrust law, and that should not be the case. That's exactly what happened with the Wright Amendment, which basically wrecked the Dallas airport market for God knows how many years, and you simply don't want that to happen. So I think no privileges, no special antitrust laws, be the same old boring stuff. I think the situation as it emerged in the 1990s, which was kind of bipartisan, has done perfectly well. And when people start to go beyond it, as with the Microsoft case on the remedial side, you run into real troubles.
We have time for one more question.
When you look at the areas of the tech economy that have experienced most dynamism in recent years, I would point to enterprise markets where you've seen companies adopt Linux-based technologies like AWS and Microsoft Azure, and unleashed software service and the economy that's come as a result of that. And then I would also point to Android and the adoption of that as a mobile operating system and the ways in which that's encouraged innovation in mobile app space. And then when you talk about the issues that you brought up, right? So, for example, the Facebook.
And who brought up?
Both of you talking about it, right? Facebook. And isn't really a lot of that driven by a lack of transparency and a lack of, lack of using open source technologies? And in that way, isn't really the solution to a lot of these problems not antitrust, but requiring or encouraging the adoption of open source technologies by tech
companies? By the
companies.
Way, I mean, you use two words interconnectedly, which just never be linked together, encouraging and requiring. You can encourage anything you darn well, please, but please don't
require.
Trying
to please both sides.
Yeah, I mean, but to give you one illustration, the Unix thing comes up, and what Microsoft says to you, you're a rump amateur. You want to have the box open and everything done. It's software for dummies. We'll supply you because we know you're a dummy. And on the other hand, people who actually put together their own networks, they go to Unix, you get a perfectly good segregation, right as it is.
Yeah, I have the last thing on this. I stand second to nobody in my belief and faith in open platforms as driving entrepreneurial innovative conduct, the same as you said. And I think the importance of the antitrust laws is in telling companies if they're going to operate an open platform that they can't trick people. They can't pretend it's open and say, well, here's this open platform, and then come along later and play with the game. So it offers a warning, people running open platforms, they really have to be open. That was the offshoot of the Microsoft case. I think that was one of its most important ideas, and that's why its tradition, I think, is important, because we need to have open platform companies understand that if they want the benefits of promising an open platform, they really do have to keep it open.
Thank God Tim is a libertarian. He's basically argued for an anti-fraud proposition with respect to open software.
Okay, and we now go to the summary part of the evening. I'm afraid we'll have to cut off all the questions. I hope that both of you guys will stick around because I think that a number of the people in the audience are going to want to chat with you afterwards. But meanwhile, we want to go to the summations. So take it away, Ted.
Sure. 5 minutes. Thanks. I'm confident you'll be able to fill it. So I think what we face tonight, and I think it's been a good debate, is the classic question of monopoly and the U.S. system and the U.S. economy. And I want to suggest that we at the United States came up with an innovative answer, a classic answer to the problem of monopoly, and that is the antitrust laws. They are a middle point, I would suggest, between a full laissez-faire form of capitalism and other central planning, socialistic answers. And I think has had an extraordinary track record over the last century for the U.S. economy, based on the idea, the sort of basic principle idea, that competition is better than monopoly. And what I want to suggest, and I want to say that that's true both in the economic side, where over the long run, I think that stagnant industries dominated by one monopolist or two monopolists do underperform competitive industries over the long period, whether it's innovation, whether it's growth, on any measure. I don't think it's seriously in question. But I also think this is an important matter when we think about the broader speech and political consequences. I think that, and I reiterated this multiple times, that there is always a danger from too little accountability, too much control and too little, few hands over speech, over data, over privacy, and that those questions are not new, but they have been settled and repeatedly addressed by the idea of telling private industry that there is a final constraint on their power, that there is some sort of final oversight backstop beyond which they cannot go, and that is through using illegal means to maintain a monopoly and merging to monopoly. And one of the things I want to emphasize is that, you know, so much of what Richard Epstein wants to happen, so much of this idea of churn, of new companies coming in the industry, of new voices being heard, is a result of some kind of outer limit on you may not do this. And that's what I'm talking about when I'm talking about the revival of antitrust. That's what I'm talking about when I'm saying we can't pretend we're living in the year 2005 and the internet is just, you know, 1,000 firms and there's no competitive advantages to anybody and platforms don't last. We have lived through an experience of consolidation in the internet industries. They are not the industries they were before. They are controlled by fewer and fewer players. And I think they have to be watched very carefully. We can't preemptively say, you know, we don't care about anything that is done in these areas. We need to be very serious about the problem of buying out competitors, of creating barriers to entry, and last of what I said earlier, which is the problem of asking for statutory monopoly and asking for special government protection against competition. That's the direction where I'm concerned that we're going to see the future go. So if I end this, I would return to where I began and say we've had a successful track record in America in challenging our most successful, challenging our dominant firms, and it has taken the United States to preeminence, to leadership in the tech industry. Now is not the time to say the tech industry can do no wrong. Now is not the time to say that we're going to allow any, bless any merger just because we think there's something special
about big tech. I think it's time for scrutiny. I think it's time to make it understood that there is some kind of final backstop, and I think that policy and that policy alone is the kind of thing that will maintain the vibrancy of the U.S. economy and also preserve the conditions of democracy, which seem under greater threat than ever. So thank you very much. I appreciate your time.
Okay. Let's sort of start from the beginning about what it is that we do with the problem of monopoly and how we deal with it. I mean, the first point to understand is that antitrust is not the only tool that has to work for that. There's also the large history of regulated industries, which actually started the same year as the passage of the Sherman Act, 1890, with the Minnesota rate cases, because there's some monopolies that you can't break up, so rate regulation, some other form of regulation is appropriate. That system of regulation generally doesn't work so much for the internet situation because they don't charge prices like you do for electricity or for gasoline. And so what you can't do is to sort of try and control the rates when the rates turn out to be zero. You could try to alter other things in the mix that are going to take place. But generally speaking, if you tell people, for example, that you're not going to get advertisement and you have to pay for things, that's going to probably be far more disastrous than anything else. When it comes to the antitrust laws, we've had a very erratic situation. Even when you go back to the age of big business and the way in which these things work, Northern Pacific survives. They go after Standard Oil, and they manage to do so just after it's lost its monopoly power in that particular industry, a point which is debated. But you give a very large industry, and you've got a lot of moving technologies. Other people are going to come in. The antitrust laws through basically the late 1940s through the mid-1970s was generally a very bad body of law. Some of the merger stuff in cases like Bonds Grocery and so forth, a brown shoe, were the sorts of things that happened where you prevented very small companies from mergers, and it was only when we had the discipline of using the Herfindahl Index to measure what the concentration ratios ought to be that we brought that to some degree of a situation. And so what Tim says is surely true, that we prefer competition to monopoly, and nothing I've ever said would ever want to deny that. It is also surely true that we never want to let anybody, whether a competitor or a monopolist, go to the government and get some kind of special favor or dispensation which puts differential costs on their competitors. That's just essentially an abuse of the public process, and we need to take steps to make sure that government doesn't have that kind of discretion, which is one of the reasons why I've argued very strongly for a strong takings clause in the Constitution to prevent that kind of government discretion from moving resources from one party to another. It is, in fact, a self-conscious effort to try to limit rent-seeking that takes place, and you can only do that at the government level. You should expect all private firms, good, bad, or indifferent, to want to engage in behavior that will benefit themselves, whether they do so in ways that benefit the social welfare or whether they do so in ways that are antithetical to that social welfare, and that's a reality. But when you want to try to apply these particular positions, you really have to be very, very careful. You have to know who is a monopoly, and you have to know whether a particular merger turns out to be something that is anti-competitive. You have to worry about whether or not it's the dominant player whom you're stopping or whether it's something else. If you look at the history of the antitrust laws, what you discover is it divides itself into three categories. Category number one is per se offenses, where except in narrow circumstances, you think that the consequences are likely to be bad, and the rules with respect to cartelization and the collective refusal to deal are things that actually match that, and the antitrust does it. The merger law is very, very much more difficult. So if you go back to Ollie Williamson's classical paper on this, he gives you a little diagram, and he shows that when the merger starts to take place, it's got some restrictive power on the one hand, and it has some efficiencies on the other, and you have to figure out which of these two forces turns out to be dominant, and that requires a kind of an inquiry that you cannot do in court. And so what you have to do is to have some administrative body do that. We had that all the way through this particular period. Tim may disappear with the results that happened there, but the people who made these judgments certainly had the right criteria, and I think in many particular cases, what they did is they came up with the right result. And then third, you always have to worry about cases of predation. And I think those are extremely dangerous cases to be, because to the extent that you call something predation, which drives out somebody else, you may well be confusing an efficient victor with an evil victor. And what happens is you're proposing anti-competitive strategies through the antitrust law. And so the basic lesson that you have to learn is that the antitrust law is like every other tool that we have in government. Sometimes it works for good. Sometimes it works for bad. What you really need to do is to figure out a filter which way in which it's going to go. As I've tried to indicate, stopping the various kinds of inefficient mergers, stopping abuses of government power, stopping private mechanisms that engage in force of fraud are all part of what we need, but breaking up big tech is not. Thank you.
And it looks as though we are getting the results that Jane is handing me. And so I will read the results. Okay. Again, antitrust should take the initiative to control the size of big tech companies. The yes vote initially got 27.2% and picked up votes to 30.1. That's a 2.9% gain for the yes vote. That's the number to beat. The no vote got 43%, went to 61%, a 17% gain. So the no vote gets the Tootsie Roll. Congratulations to you both on picking up votes. No, get